On September 27, 2004, 18-year-old Brittany Phillips had what appeared to be a typical day in the life of a college student. She spent time with her friends and called her mom later that night to catch up. But after that phone call, no one saw or heard from Brittany again. She didn't show up for classes, she didn't check in with any of her friends, and she didn't return any of her mother's calls. Days passed without no word until September 30th, when one of her friends called the police. When officers arrived and entered the apartment, they found Brittany on the floor next to her bed. She had been strangled and possibly sexually assaulted. There were no obvious signs of forced entry, but detectives collected DNA from the scene, hoping that somewhere in that evidence was the identity of her killer. Now, more than 20 years later, that DNA has not resulted in any arrests, leaving her friends and family still seeking justice. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Lavasser. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. Okay, so Brittany Phillips, this is going to be a fascinating case tonight. Why? Well, what if I told you in tonight's episode, we're going to discuss a case that has semen, that has blood, and yet due to an unexpected twist, there has never been an arrest. I'm going to tell you right now, as we go through this case, you're going to look at the scenario that we're dealing with, especially if you're watching on YouTube and you see some of the photos, and you're going to think, how after all these years, 20 plus years, do we still not have answers? And then to add to that, the forensic evidence that was collected and what has been done with it, the fact that no one has been identified as the potential offender or the killer, it's puzzling. And we're going to break it all down. We're going to talk about it because this is a rarity. It's not often, especially with today's science and technology, where you have this much DNA evidence and you have people in the field of DNA looking at this evidence and we don't have the person in custody. And I have to give a special thank you to Maggie, Brittany's mother. She worked with our researcher, Polly, on this episode to make sure that all the facts were correct because that's the most important thing here. We're starting to get a lot of people who are coming over and listening or watching these episodes, and I want to make sure that we're giving them the correct information. Because the last thing I want any of us to do is build a house on a bad foundation. So having people who have been directly affected by this and who have unfortunately been living this nightmare since day one, it's a critical part of this, and we wouldn't be able to do it the way we're doing it without them. So thanks again, Maggie, for your assistance on this episode. So we have a lot to cover. I can't wait to give you my perspective. So let's not waste any more time. Let's dive into this week's case. Brittany Phillips was born on October 4th, 1985 in St. Petersburg, Florida to her parents, Dr. Maggie Zingman and John Phillips. Maggie often referred to her daughter as Britty, and she described her as smart, beautiful, and full of love. When Brittany was still young, the family relocated to Oklahoma, where she later attended Union High School, while her mother worked as a psychologist at Mabel Bassett Correctional Center, a women's prison in McLeod, Oklahoma. After graduating high school in 2003, Brittany enrolled in college in St. Petersburg, Florida, and after her first year, she started to feel homesick. She missed Oklahoma, her friends, her family, and she decided to transfer back to Tulsa Community College. Brittany planned to finish her prerequisites at TCC and then transfer to Oklahoma State University, where she would major in pharmaceutical research. A decision that was deeply personal. See, after losing her grandmother to cancer, Brittany wanted to be part of finding a cure. Before the fall semester of 2004 began, she found an apartment near her college. It was a unit at the Glen Eagles Apartments located at 9407 East 65th Street in Tulsa. She moved in that summer while her mother was living in Chandler, which was about an hour away. Brittany was excited to be back home. She had her close friends nearby, and she spoke with her mom often. On Monday, September 27th, Brittany wasn't feeling well due to allergies, so she went to urgent care. Later that same day, she spent time with friends just a few miles from her apartment, and that evening, she dropped a friend off at 8 p.m., said goodbye, and headed home. At around 9 p.m., she called her mom, and Maggie remembers that call very clearly. Brittany told her about her visit to urgent care and talked about her day. They chatted for a while, and then Brittany said goodnight. That was the last time Maggie ever spoke to her daughter. The following day, on September 28th, Brittany was supposed to attend an 8 a.m. class, but she never showed up. At first, no one was immediately worried. That's not unexpected, right? On top of that, she hadn't been feeling well the day before, and it wasn't unreasonable to think that maybe, hey, she needs some more rest, she's just going to stay home. But as the day went on and calls to her phone went unanswered, concerns began to build. Maggie and several of Brittany's friends tried reaching her repeatedly in the days that followed, but there were no return calls, no updates, and no indication of where she might be. Then on September 30th, one of Brittany's friends decided to stop by her apartment to check on her. When she got there, she found the door to Brittany's second floor unit unlocked, but when she called out to Brittany, there was no reply. She called the police and requested a welfare check, and officers arrived at the apartment around 10 p.m. that night. And what they found would change the lives of Brittany's friends and family forever. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back, and we're talking about what police found when they arrived. So inside the apartment, Brittany was found on the floor next to her bed. She was wearing only a shirt, and according to the medical examiner's report, she was on her back with her head turned to the right. The examiner noted, quote, there were numerous towels on Brittany and items of clothing adjacent to her. Her death was later ruled a homicide due to asphyxia, and the report outlined multiple signs of suffocation, including petechial hemorrhaging, which are small blood vessels that burst in the eyes, and also abrasions on her neck. And while the suffocation was evident, there was no indication of strangulation. Her hyoid bone was still intact, and there were no ligature marks present. And I do agree with this assessment. By no means am I a medical examiner, but I will say I've worked cases where the hyoid bone was intact, and yet there was strangulation. So it's not a one-for-one. It's not always an absolute. But with a high degree of certainty, in this particular case, based on what we do have, it's more than likely that she was suffocated with a hand or a pillow. It has also been widely reported that there were signs that Brittany had been sexually assaulted, but according to the documentary Tulsa, Who Killed Brittany Phillips, there was no notation in the records that a rape kit had been collected. Now, Maggie relayed to us that she was told at the time that a rape kit had been administered, but she has never seen a report confirming it. And that is a little concerning. I hope that the kit was done, but they just didn't mention it in the report, which is a flub. It should be in the report. That's the best outcome. What I'm really hoping is not the case is that they didn't do the rape kit, and because they were caught on the spot, maybe they told Maggie they did when they really didn't. I'm really hopeful that's not the case, but we have to at least entertain it. The fact that we don't have any documentation proving it, or at least something from a chain of custody perspective where you can see that the rape kit was administered and then placed into evidence. There should be an evidence tag, a seizure report, all that stuff done for that, where you don't have to show us the whole report, but you can at least confirm that that kit was placed into a secured area. So based on everything they knew so far, detectives believe that Brittany had been killed sometime after she spoke with Maggie at 9 p.m. on the 27th, and before her class was scheduled to begin at 8 a.m. the following morning. So you have a pretty decent sized window here. A lot can happen between 9 p.m. and 8 a.m. And when you think about the fact that they're in an apartment complex, that also complicates things. But as far as what we know as we're covering this case, what do I think just about the preliminary information we have? The fact that the door was unlocked, that is an interesting point. We have someone who could have easily come in through the front door or who had left through the front door. And we're also going to talk about points of egress as we get further in this case. Obviously, I've already read it. I won't go into that now. As far as the positioning in the way that she was found, And the fact that she only had her t-shirt on, yes, I think more than likely she had been sexually assaulted. I think when it comes to the asphyxiation, the reason I lean towards a hand and or a pillow is not only because of the lack of the hyoid bone being broken and also the lack of ligature marks. It's also the fact that the way her head was positioned. If you think about it, if someone was on top of you and they're holding a pillow over your head, you're going to do whatever you can to try and breathe. And more than likely, that would result in you turning your head to the left or to the right to try to breathe out the side of the pillow where the pressure is not coming from. But if the pillow is wrapped around your head, you're probably still going to have negative results. It's going to be, especially if it's a large pillow, pretty easy to cut off all air supply. And when you're struggling and fighting for your life, you're going to lose oxygen even faster. So having all that, including the petechial hemorrhaging, like I said, those blood vessels popping in the eyes, it is highly likely that after being sexually assaulted, she was suffocated. Now, in the hours that followed the discovery of Brittany's body, investigators collected DNA samples from throughout the apartment as well as from her body. Semen was discovered on her bedsheets, and blood was found near the kitchen sink. In addition to that, other unidentified DNA was also present at the scene, and that was collected as well. Detectives went on to examine each possible entry point to Brittany's second floor apartment, but found no clear signs of forced entry. However, the sliding door that led to her balcony was ajar, and at least one neighbor told police that Brittany was known to keep that door unlocked. In fact, on one occasion after locking herself out of the apartment, she asked another resident to help her, and that resident lifted her up onto the balcony so that she could re-enter through the unlocked door. Detectives also noted that her windows were open at the time she was found, which brought up yet another possibility, that the perpetrator had entered through one of the windows and left through the front door. This method, like the others, wouldn't have left any signs of forced entry. Detectives also learned of yet another possible access point, one that was a lot less obvious, but in my opinion, much more concerning. You see, inside Brittany's bedroom, there was a closet, and within that closet, there was a small door that led to a shared attic space that linked her apartment to at least seven others in the building. And the reason why this is so concerning is because the way the complex was laid out, this meant that anyone with access to any of those nearby units could have moved through the attic and entered Brittany's apartment without ever setting foot outside. And so this is a big problem for detectives because there's a real possibility that someone who resides in one of these units, and maybe them or someone who was staying with them, who was aware of this shared attic, could have committed this crime without ever being seen by anyone. In fact, to the outside people, they would appear to have been in their apartment all night long. So although it's a big issue, it is something that can be vetted, right? We can go to those seven units and we can thoroughly interview and potentially interrogate all of them to make sure we know who was in those apartments, what are their criminal histories like, have they had any prior incidents, and also try to nail them down to a specific alibi so that you can compare and contrast later on in the investigation. So that's my detective hat being on, but let me take that one off for a second and put my dad hat on, or put my human being hat on. What are we doing? Why would the property owners not secure those doors? They're obviously aware of them, but every single one of those doors should have been secured with a lock that only one or two people would have access to, because there's a bigger problem here. Yes, I just mentioned the residents who could have entered through one of those units into Brittany's apartment. What about maintenance workers? What about construction workers? If any of those people knew about that little shared attic, they could have also used that area if they had access to one of those units. They could have used a key to get into the apartment, gone in through the door in the closet, up into the attic, into Brittany's apartment, and then back out the same way. So just from a legal perspective, there should have been some type of security measures implemented to ensure that even though those doors were there, no one from one unit could enter another unit. That would have been the right move here. And I don't know what we can do without understanding what actually happened, but if it's determined that that was the way that Brittany's killer got in and out of the apartment, well, then they have a big lawsuit on their hands, and I'm sure Maggie is already well aware of that. Now, back to the DNA evidence, because that's extremely important to this case, right? It's always great when a detective goes in and they find DNA and blood inside the apartment after a murder. That could be potentially critical to this case. So, as you would expect, they sent that DNA and other evidence off to the lab for testing. Meanwhile, while all this is going on, Brittany's friends and family began preparing for her funeral. It was held on October 4th, 2004, what should have been her 19th birthday. And instead of celebrating, her friends and family spent the day mourning everything she never got the chance to do. In her obituary, Maggie wrote, quote, "My little girl with long blonde curls, you were taken too soon. Your youth and aged wisdom are now locked inside. You were the smiling, spinning, dancing pony princess. You were the young woman who wanted to research ways to heal. A future healing that Brittany never got the chance to fulfill." Now, as the investigation continued, results from the lab came back. Detectives learned that two of the samples, one from the semen found on Brittany's sheets and another from the blood located near the kitchen sink, belonged to the same person. With that connection, law enforcement felt reasonably confident that whoever left those samples was responsible for Brittany's murder. But when they ran the DNA through the system, there was no match. In an effort to generate new leads, a billboard campaign was launched across Tulsa. The first sign went up at Interstate 244 and Utica Avenue, with the plan to rotate its location every few months over the course of a year. The hope was that the increased visibility would lead to new tips. And the tips did come in, but still, there were no answers. 3 years after Brittany's murder, detectives decided to release more information to the public, hoping it might jog someone's memory. They shared that a purple pillowcase had been found inside Brittany's apartment. It didn't match any of her existing bedding, and detectives thought it might belong to the killer. They noted that it had a faded or bleached spot near the end that didn't open, and there was no brand or identifying marks to trace it. For years, detectives kept this information about the pillowcase from the public, hoping it was something only the killer would know. But with no leads, they decided it was worth sharing in case someone recognized it. Detective Jeff Felton told Tulsa World, quote, "We believe that the perpetrator may have brought the pillowcase with him and left it behind." He went on to explain that burglars often carry pillowcases with them to collect valuable items during a break-in, and said it was possible that the person responsible for Brittany's murder had done the same. Felton urged the public to come forward with any information, stating, quote, "We are looking for information from anyone who maybe has a suspicious boyfriend or suspicious roommate who is out at odd hours of the night or may recall having a pillowcase like this missing." And I know some of you may be in the comments right now asking me, Derek, why wouldn't they put out this pillowcase information immediately when the case was still fresh? And there's two schools of thought on that, but I am in the camp of, if there's certain little tidbits of information that most people would not be aware of, that may not be a direct contributor to solving the case, you do want to hold that back. Because if a witness or a potential suspect comes forward and they identify something that was in that room that no one should know about, well, that's credible information, and it also could be guilt knowledge. So if you expose everything you have initially, you lose that, and it hurts your ability to build a case after the fact. So I understand it, and I probably would have done the same thing I have in other cases. There are cases that I covered on Breaking Homicide, which was a TV show, and there was information that I knew in a couple of the cases that was trivial, and I could have put it out there, but I chose not to, just in case we got a tip that led to them stating something like, hey, at that particular crime scene, there was this item there. If they had said that on a phone call with me, then I know they're telling the truth. So I'm guilty of this as well. I think 3 years, relatively speaking, is still pretty fast. And so I condone what they did here. I think it's the right move. The trail started to go cold. And as soon as it did, they dropped another piece of information. So I'm completely on board with it. And as far as the philosophy of a robber carrying a pillowcase in after stealing items, I've seen that before. Yeah, I've seen garbage bags, pillowcases, backpacks, you name it. The only problem that I have with it is, to me, it appears that the offender here went there for one reason and one reason only, and that was to sexually assault Brittany and kill her. I don't think they went there to steal any of her items. I don't think she ever gave the indication that she was in possession of valuable items. So I don't know what the pillowcase would have been for. I don't know if it's a red herring, and maybe it was a pillowcase that she had acquired from somebody else while sleeping over at someone's house or whatever. There's a million reasons that pillowcase could have been in there. So it's not 100% certainty that it belongs to the killer, but in a case like this where you're just looking for that one piece of evidence that could connect all the dots, it could be as simple as a pillowcase. So I agree with their approach here. Unfortunately, this new piece of information didn't lead to anything substantial, and as months turned into years and frustration grew with the lack of answers, Brittany's mother continued to place her trust in the work being done by the Tulsa Police Department. Maggie truly believed the detectives were doing everything they could to keep Brittany's case from going cold. She saw firsthand how much effort they were putting in, and for a long time she felt they were going above and beyond. Still, Maggie felt like she needed to do more. So she reached out to the media, trying to get Brittany's story in the news, on the television, any outlet that would listen. And in 2007, the same year the new details about the pillowcase were released, she came up with an idea, and she called it Caravan to Catch a Killer. In October of that year, Maggie set off on her first awareness road trip, visiting 8 cities in a vehicle covered in pink and purple, Brittany's favorite colors, and filled with posters bearing her daughter's face. Everywhere she went, she stopped to speak with local news stations and share Brittany's story. Since then, she continued the caravan, traveling to new places each year, hoping to keep Brittany's name and the search for justice alive. Back in Tulsa, detectives pressed forward with their investigation. They interviewed more than 100 people and tested the DNA evidence recovered in Brittany's case against profiles of 1,700 convicted felons, but still, no match came back. As the roadblocks piled up, Maggie turned her attention to policy reform. She began advocating for a law that would require DNA to be collected at the time of the arrest, not just upon conviction. She believed that a larger database could make all the difference in unsolved cases like Brittany's. And by the way, I completely agree. In 2016, her advocacy efforts paid off and the measure was passed. But due to lack of funding, the initiative didn't last long. And this is a very unfortunate aspect of investigations. How many times have I said to you over the years that a case should never not be solved due to a lack of funding? We all agree with that. The problem is there is a money amount attached to all of this. Staffing, resources, technology, equipment, it all costs money. And it's got to come from somewhere. And when legislators are looking for the different things to fund, sometimes things like this can be left out in the cold. And so when the money dries up, there's no way to do it. And it's unfortunate because the same thing goes for rape kits, right? I talk about those all the time as well. There are thousands of rape kits that have not been tested yet. And I hate to be the one to tell you, but a lot of that is due to the lack of funding. It's unacceptable. It should never be the case. It's why we started Criminal Coffee. We're just trying to do a small part. And I think with all the people in true crime and the influence that we have, if we all took a stand against this and we continue to promote it, there's no doubt we can make a difference. But this is just another sad example of something I completely agree with and would absolutely help solve cases, and yet there's no money for it. It's got to change. Now, on a positive note, time was passing, and as it did, advancements in DNA technology gave law enforcement a new direction to explore. Tulsa police submitted the unknown DNA profile from Brittany's case to Parabon Nanolabs, a company known for its work in creating composite images using genetic markers. I've seen it before. They sometimes refer to it as a snapshot. It's incredible. There have been multiple cases where Parabon has came in, took the DNA, developed this composite sketch, and when they identify the person, it matches. It's really, really impressive. But I will tell you, as a side note, not to be the bearer of bad news, I've worked with Parabon before. I love them, but I can tell you it's very expensive. It's not cheap. So again, coming back to the money, but I'm glad they were able to do it here. And the goal in this particular case was to generate a sketch of the man they believed had killed Brittany, because even though they didn't have a name, a face might help someone recognize him. To start, Parabon used genetic markers from the DNA to put together a general profile of what the man could have looked like. Results showed that the man was likely fair skin, blue or green eyes, and brown or blonde hair. Using that information, Parabon put together a composite sketch which depicted a fair-skinned man with short, sandy blonde hair and blue eyes. Now, since his age at the time of the murder was unknown, they generated an image to reflect a man around 25 years old. The sketch was widely distributed, and with it came renewed hope that someone, somewhere, would recognize the man and that the answer to Brittany's case could finally be within reach. And an answer eventually did come regarding the blood and semen found in Brittany's apartment, but it wasn't the one her family or law enforcement had hoped for. After the composite sketch was released to the public, a man came forward and said he was the person in the sketch. He explained that at the time of Brittany's murder, he had been dating one of her close friends. Now, according to reports, he admitted that he had previously been in Brittany's apartment, which could explain how his DNA ended up there. But he insisted that he hadn't been there on the night she was killed. Maggie also shared with us that the man explained the presence of his semen by saying that he and his girlfriend had sex on Brittany's bed. As for the blood, he acknowledged it was his, but his explanation as to how it got there has not been made public. All we know is that he has maintained he had nothing to do with Brittany's murder. And I will say, without knowing all the details, this could align and this story could be easily corroborated. You would go to the girl that he allegedly had sex with in Brittany's apartment, and you would ask him about this whole occurrence and see if they did in fact have sex and if she remembered where he ejaculated. You could also ask her about the blood found in the sink. If the injury happened the same night of the sexual encounter, she could easily confirm or deny what he had told police. And I can only assume that we're sitting here today without an arrest because the information lined up. It all made sense, and they were able to corroborate his story through a third party who was there as well. And they could also go to other friends and say, hey, has this guy been hanging around Brittany's apartment before? Was he hooking up with Brittany's friend? It'd be very easy to find out whether the story was true or not. And if there were any cracks in that story, I can promise you there would be a different approach to this gentleman. But as it stands right now, it looks like his story checks out. But I don't want to just completely go past this, because it's good that we've identified this person, but how demoralizing is this for not only law enforcement, but more importantly, Maggie and the rest of Brittany's family? In most cases, as I kind of started this show, if I told you we had a murder slash sexual assault and there was semen and blood found at the crime scene, and then I told you that we were able to identify that person, I believe 95% of you would say, well, then you probably solved the case, right? Who was it? This is why it's so important to follow every lead and not get tunnel vision, because until you get to that very end where you know what happened, there could be deviations in the road. And if you had told me this story as an experienced detective, I would tell you, yeah, that semen and blood has to belong to the killer, but I would be wrong. So here we are. The evidence was collected properly. Science and technology evolved. They were able to process it and identify the DNA markers. And Parabon was able to translate it into an actual image that matched the person it belonged to. And yet, here I am covering this as an unsolved case. But there is some hope here, because I was very specific in what I said. They were able to identify the semen and the blood. There was other DNA evidence collected at that crime scene that has not been tested. And that's important, because that means we still can. Now, I do want to say, for the sake of transparency, I do have more information about this DNA and where it currently stands and what it may entail and all that good stuff. But my number one goal, and I know your number one goal, is to give answers to this family. And the last thing that I would ever do is conduct myself in a way that could potentially impede that from happening. So I'm going to keep it internal. I wanted to have it for my analysis of this investigation. All I'll say is this: there's still hope. And just to kind of wrap it up on the guy who came forward with the story, police tested the DNA from the blood and semen against his profile, and it was a match. And they also verified his alibi for the night of September 27th, the time frame in which detectives believe that Britney was killed, though the specifics of this alibi have never been shared publicly. And I can understand why. This guy's out there, even though I've just said everything that I've said to you, there are still going to be people, especially after I say some more facts in this case, who think he could be responsible. And I understand that. But the last thing we want is someone out there to go and confront this guy or take the law into their own hands. That's not what we're trying to accomplish here. So based on everything I said, for the 27th, this guy's clear. But stay tuned on that. Don't completely lose me there, because there's more about this whole thing that we need to talk about. But before we go there, I want to go back to the DNA for a moment, because it's not a dead end. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, there's still hope. And I want to give you a little bit more, because I don't want to leave you on that much of a cliffhanger where you don't have any of the details, and I have been allowed to share this information. So, while the blood and semen had left this roadblock, there was still other DNA evidence that had not been tested, including material collected from underneath Britney's fingernails. That evidence was also preserved, but it was never sent for analysis. Why is that a big deal? I think most of us know. Defensive wounds, right? The DNA under her fingernails could have been caused while she's struggling for her life, while this pillow is over her head. She potentially scratches her killer on the back, on the arms, on the face, whatever it might be, and leaves their DNA under her nails to be collected later. And yet it wasn't sent off. Why? Not justifying it here, but my guess, my educated guess would be, detectives looked at the blood and the semen and said, that's our guy. Let's focus on that. We don't want to send everything at once, because there is a process. There is a turnaround time. There's sometimes finances attached to it. So let's send off our strongest evidence, because if we find the owner of that blood and semen, we find our killer. So that's what they did, and it didn't work. However, I'm happy to report that detectives have since sent those fingernail scrapings off for testing. And as of this recording, Othram is currently working on building a profile. And if that wasn't enough ups and downs in this roller coaster of a case, in early 2023, a new lead came in, one that had the potential to change everything. We're going to talk about that right after this break. All right, so we're back from break, and I know I left you kind of hanging there, so let's get right back into it. Right after the holidays, as the new year began, Maggie heard from Britney's father. He had a piece of evidence he had never shared before, something that, for whatever reason, he had kept to himself until now. It was a birthday card that Britney had sent to her grandfather, but she mailed it to her father, and this was something that she always did because she could never remember her grandfather's address. But it wasn't the card itself that stood out. It was the postmark that had been generated by the kiosk. See, this meant that the person mailing it had to physically be at the kiosk on the date and time shown on the postmark. That date was September 29th, 2004. You see, authorities had long believed that Britney was killed sometime after speaking with Maggie on the night of the 27th, likely before the morning of the 28th. But the timestamp on the card raised a new possibility that maybe Britney had been alive for at least 24 hours longer than originally thought. Now, I do want to say that no witnesses have come forward so far saying that they saw or heard from Britney on the 28th or the 29th, but it's something that definitely needs to be mentioned. Why? Well, I just got done telling you about this guy who had his blood and semen found at the crime scene. And allegedly, he has an alibi for the 27th. But what about the 28th? You see, it's possible, I'm not saying it's likely, it's possible that he could be telling the truth. He may have been in Britney's apartment before. He may have had sex with his girlfriend on Britney's bed. He may have had some type of nosebleed. But is it possible that there was something between him and Britney? Did he come over the next night? Was there something else going on that maybe his girlfriend wasn't aware of? These are all questions that need to be asked. They're reasonable. But put that aside for a second, and let's just look at what we have here on the surface. We've just potentially expanded our window in which this crime occurred from 11 hours to potentially 2 days. How much more could have transpired in that time frame? There could have been construction workers at the building. There could have been maintenance workers, security officers. And there's also a completely outside-the-box variable. If Brittany was alive and she was out and about, is it possible that maybe while dropping off this card or doing something else, someone saw her, someone who isn't familiar with her, and decided to follow her home, wait for her to get into her apartment, and then do something? Is it the most likely scenario? No. But is it in the realm of possibility with this big of a window? Absolutely. And these are all things that now, with this new information, investigators have to explore. So a very difficult job just got even harder. In September of 2024, it had been two full decades since Brittany was found murdered. Her case remained unsolved, but Maggie was as determined as ever. She was exploring every possible path to get answers, including asking the Tulsa Police Department to allow outside agencies to take a fresh look at the case. But according to her, the request wasn't exactly welcomed with open arms, and Maggie doesn't understand why. She told News on 6, quote, "It doesn't hurt anything. All it does is maybe just confirm that you've done everything. What is the harm? Please tell me what the harm is." In response to Maggie's statement, the Tulsa Police Department told News on 6 that they were open to allowing outside experts to come to the station and review the case, but made it very clear that the evidence would not be allowed to leave their office. They also stated that they have never been contacted by outside investigators requesting to assist with the case. That claim, however, was refuted by my good friend, Cheryl McCollum, director of the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute. McCollum told News on 6, quote, "I have personally reached out by phone, email, and publicly offered assistance. Please let this serve as another public offering of all of our experts to the Tulsa Police Department on the case of Brittany Phillips." And as I just mentioned, Cheryl's a good friend of mine. She's absolutely brilliant and a great investigator. So if she's offering her services, Tulsa Police Department, you should take her up on it. She's great. Despite the pushback from the police, Maggie will not stop fighting. She told News on 6, quote, "Brittany was always a fighter. When I'm fighting for her, I'm fighting for her voice." Today, Maggie continues her journey with Caravan to Catch a Killer, a mission that has taken her to 48 states. Her car is still wrapped in Brittany's photos, set against a pink and purple background, and she's already planning her next trip, which will include a stop at CrimeCon in Denver this September. I will be there, and I hope to meet you, Maggie. And with every mile that she drives, Maggie holds on to the same hope she's had since 2004, that someday she'll finally have answers. All right, let's dive into this perspective and elaborate on some of the things I covered in this case, because I covered a lot. As I look at this case from the outside, I know we're talking about a pillowcase and potential that the offender was going to steal some items and put them in this bag. I don't know if that's the case. For me, I believe from the start, this crime was sexual in nature. And it reminds me a lot of a case that I worked on breaking homicide, Faith Hedgepeth. Similar circumstances, not exact. There were some other variables in it, but it was a young woman in an apartment complex, not really many ways in and out. And yet we went years without knowing who killed her. And recently, someone was arrested for that crime, and it wasn't who we thought it would be. It was someone that, as far as we know right now, didn't really have much of a connection to Faith. There may have been some deliveries made there where he might have encountered her once or twice, but this wasn't a friend, and this wasn't a family member. This wasn't an ex-partner. This wasn't someone that she had seen at the club that night. And these were all the big, big theories that were going around, including by me and my team. So this case has a very similar feel to it. And as we look at the different potential suspects in this case, obviously you have to look at friends, family, and previous partners. And that goes back to the gentleman that I mentioned here who was a friend of, I guess, Britney's friend, but I'm assuming he was a friend of hers as well. And although it might look great on the surface, you have to wonder if there's other things that most people didn't know about. It wouldn't be the first time that someone cheated on their significant other or had multiple partners. We don't know everything that was going on in Britney's life. And because she's no longer here, we can't ask her. So I'm definitely looking internally first at people that she was close to for a variety of reasons. They would kind of know her layout. They would know maybe her sleep schedule. They would also be aware of some of the conditions of the apartment. What do I mean by that? The fact that she would leave the back door on the porch, the balcony unlocked, kind of ajar. The fact that maybe she didn't secure her windows a lot because she was on the second floor. These are things that would definitely be known by the people closest to her. However, to change gears for a second, they could also be known by residents, maintenance workers, security officials that were there. They could be known by a construction team that had been working for a previous job at that location. Because again, from the outside, looking up at her apartment, you would be able to see that the door was open or the windows were open. It wouldn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. And I haven't even mentioned again this whole shared attic space that may not have even been known to all of the residents, but would definitely be known to property managers and any maintenance workers that had to facilitate different jobs on that property, maybe up in the attic. Maybe there were pipes, maybe there were electrical wires, different things that you would need access to conduct work that needed to be done without entering the actual apartment. And then you also have to think about the residents, right? Like the residents that could have been living in one of those apartments and their friends and associates. So it's a lot of work. There's a lot of potential suspects here. And what we need to do is go through as many names as we can identify and look at their criminal history before and after this incident occurred. We have 20 years of data to kind of go through at this point. Maybe this person didn't have any crimes before. Maybe they reoffended again after Britney. We don't know until we check. So although it's tedious work and it's going to take a lot of personnel and a lot of time, you got to go through and put together that list so you have a visual and one by one go through all these individuals and see if anything pops. Is there anything in their history that would suggest a similar MO? Maybe not a complete carry out of a murder, but a domestic assault or a potential sexual assault, or even just a call where they were accused of something that could be in the same vein of what we're dealing with here. That's just on the surface. That's just the grunt work that needs to be done. Then we transition to the actual evidence we already have. The blood and semen. Little bit of a setback there. We know who it belonged to, but as I said in the episode, now we have this bigger window of opportunity. It may not just have been those 11 hours. It may be up to 2 days. So you got to go back and talk to him and revet his story. You also have to think about the construction workers that would have been there during that time frame who may have had access to that building as well. If they're unaccounted for by their colleagues or by their friends, they need to be spoken to. But back to the DNA evidence for a second here. We got the blood and semen, but we also have the unknown DNA under the fingernails. And that's with Othram right now. And anybody who's been following true crime for any period of time, you know who Othram is. They're out of Texas, Houston, I believe. They've solved multiple cold cases using DNA that was recovered 20, 30, 40 years ago. So they're very good at what they do. They've got it down to a science, literally. So if anybody's going to be able to identify that DNA under the fingernail, it's going to be Othram. And there's others that could do it as well. I work with Intermountain Forensics all the time. They're great as well. They all have the similar technology to kind of do this work. It just needs to be done. And they're doing it. So that's a positive. There are some hurdles, and I've heard them directly from the people that work in these cases all the time. People at GEDmatch and people like my genetic genealogist, Ryan and Jeremy. And one thing that I've learned from speaking with them on how we can all help and how we can all assist is that, yes, we have convicted felons who are entered into these systems. And we also have a lot of people who volunteer their DNA to try to build a more robust DNA database. But the one thing that I've learned is that when they're looking for signups, one thing they lack is people who are African-American descent or Hispanic descent, people who are from Latin countries or African countries. if you're okay with doing this, we would love for you to come forward and volunteer your DNA, because even if you're not directly connected to this person, you could have some type of ancestral connection, which may link back to them through a family tree analysis. And that's what the job of Jeremy and Ryan is to do. So the more people we have, the more connections we could have in this family tree, which may help us find the killer or someone who's related to the killer. Either would be fine, because once we have a person identified, someone like me, an investigator, can go boots on the ground and go speak to this person and see who they're related to and who's from the area of the crime that was committed. But again, at the root of it, we need the DNA. We need those samples to be in the database so that when we enter the suspect's DNA into our system, if they happen to be of Latin American descent or African American descent, there's a higher probability that we'll find a match that's relatively close so we can follow that lead. And the reason that I'm harping on that aspect so much tonight is because of what I think happened here. It's my opinion. If this isn't someone who's closely connected to Brittany, which I think if it was, we would have a match by now, then that leads me to believe that it's more than likely someone who was working at the property, not full-time, but for a temporary period of time, maybe in the field of construction. Why do I say that? Well, if Tulsa is doing their job, they vetted all the residents there and they asked for DNA to compare it to what they have. And if they were able to get most of those people, they were able to cancel them out. The people they wouldn't be able to get would be if there was a contracting company there and there were workers working for them who don't want to speak to law enforcement for whatever reason. And if they're not keeping an accurate list of who's working on that site at that particular apartment, or maybe just an area nearby, it doesn't have to be at the complex. It's very possible that the person we're looking for is slipping through the cracks. And to me, that is the most plausible scenario, that this person is someone with no direct connection to that apartment complex or Brittany, but they've been there before and they may have seen Brittany and they may have seen her alone. And on this particular occasion, they noticed that maybe the door to the balcony was ajar, or they were walking through the hallway and realized as they were hand-checking doors that hers was unlocked, and they went inside. And I'm not going to go over the details. I think we can all deduce what happened in that room, but they were able to escape that apartment without being seen, unfortunately. Could have been through a window, could have been through the balcony, or it could have been right out the front door. And it also, as scary as it is to talk about this, could have been that closet door with the trap door that led up to the attic. And that would definitely lean towards a construction or maintenance worker, because not everyone's going to know about that. Not every resident in that apartment complex would be aware of that door unless you come back and tell me that there were clusters of units throughout the apartment complex and they were all connected by these trap doors. But even then, I would push back and say, I really hope law enforcement has gone to each and every resident and gathered as much evidence and as much DNA as they could, because if they didn't, they're not doing their job. So I'm working off the premise that they did that, and there may be people that they're unable to identify and therefore haven't spoken with or retrieved their DNA. Which, as always, leads me back to you guys. We have to identify every possible suspect. And I really hope that there's someone out there somewhere who is in that vicinity who may have information to lead to any potential suspects who have not been identified yet and have not had their DNA compared to the DNA we currently have. So with that being said, just to recap, 18-year-old Brittany Phillips was last heard from at around 9 p.m. on the night of September 27th, 2004, while speaking with her mother on the phone. She was supposed to attend an 8 a.m. class the following morning, but she never showed up. Days later, on the night of September 30th, Brittany was found dead in her apartment on East 65th Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma. She had been suffocated and may have been sexually assaulted. Anyone with information about Brittany's case is urged to contact the Tulsa Police Department's Cold Case Unit by email at tbdcoldcasehomicide@cityoftulsa.org. My final words tonight are going to be a little different. I'm first going to speak to the Tulsa Police Department if anybody's listening or watching. By all accounts, from what I've heard, you did a great job. You dotted your I's, you crossed your T's. You've done everything you can to solve this case. It doesn't hurt to allow someone else to come in and give a fresh perspective. Maybe they come to the same conclusion, but maybe they have some angles that have yet to be explored. They may also have some resources and contacts that may assist in analyzing a part of the case that currently you don't have the staff to do. That doesn't mean you're not good at your job. It just points out the obvious that every police department has strengths and weaknesses based on personnel and resources. And whenever we are offered the opportunity to work with great people like a Cheryl McCollum, we want to take advantage of that because the number one responsibility is to solve this case. And if there's someone out there that can help you do that, give them the opportunity to do so. And as far as Brittany's friends and family, my thoughts go out to you, specifically Maggie. Again, thank you so much for working with us on this episode and allowing me to tell your daughter's story. I know you will not stop until you find out what happened to Brittany, and we're right here with you. I really hope we have information soon, and I hope I get to talk to you at CrimeCon about this case. If there's anything I can do to help, I'm with you. I'm here until we get the answers we're looking for. Until then, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.